Some companies pause in Europe and elsewhere when they look at doing business with Iran. Economists say people inside Iran at the basic street level, ordinary Iranians, they're not seeing much change. However, critics in Washington and elsewhere will point out the Revolutionary Guard, the elite military unit that has its hands in a lot of the economic pie in Iran. They have benefited from the lifting of sanctions, and that's increasing what they called Iran's malign behavior in the region. So they want more talks. Curb the missile program and other things that Iran really has shown no interest in.
And Peter, on the world stage, I mean, some of the narratives you hear about Iran is, you know, for one, they have this enormous growing influence, which has some people in the region very scared. They're in this sort of larger war for influence with Saudi Arabia. And so that's a tension and a pressure. And then you have the United States putting Iran on the top list of global threats in the world. So if you're Iran, how does Iran respond to all of that?
Well, if you're a hardliner in Iran, one of the clerics and one of the very conservative types, this is about what you expect from the U.S. anyway. They see America as their main enemy. In a way, they're comfortable with the Trump administration in ways that they would not have been with Barack Obama. Now, the struggle against Saudi Arabia, which you mentioned, has sectarian overtones, the Saudis being a leading Sunni Muslim power, Iran's a leading Shiite power, and it's playing out mainly in third countries, like in Yemen, where Iran is backing these rebels, the Houthis, who are fighting a coalition led by Saudi Arabia and even launching missiles toward Riyadh. So Iran is also supporting Shiite militias in Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere. And these situations are not likely to get better anytime soon.
Anything in particular that you think we should look for as the new year starts?
Well, I think it's more questions than answered. Basically, the Trump administration is promising a tougher policy. We haven't seen the details. U.S. allies are not thrilled with the idea. But I think as Iranians look ahead, they've just got a lot of questions.
NPR's Peter Kenyon reporting for us in Istanbul. Peter, thanks.
Thanks, David.
For years, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has made sexual harassment one of the top issues on her political agenda. So this past fall, as allegations of harassment swept through the U.S. Capitol, it was no surprise that Senator Gillibrand became a leading voice on how to handle the issue. NPR's Scott Detrow examines how the cultural moment is also boosting her political stature.
There's a small chance that if Saturday Night Live hadn't been so mean to David Paterson, Kirsten Gillibrand wouldn't be in the U.S. Senate.
And it's bad out there, Seth. I mean, if you don't believe me, take a look at this graph that I got here. Now,
in late 2008, Hillary Clinton was vacating her Senate seat, and the New York governor was trying to decide who should fill it. The show was mocking him over and over, mostly for being blind.
Governor, it's upside down.
You bet it is.
Paterson says his staff advised him to laugh along with the jokes, but when the upstate New York congresswoman came and met with him about the Senate job, Gillibrand urged him to fight back, saying it was wrong for the show to target a disability.
Sometimes you're in the right place at the right time. That consoling and yet strong support she gave me that moment stuck in my mind for a month and a half until I appointed her U.S. Senator.
There were many other reasons Paterson picked Gillibrand, but 9 years later, she now has held the Senate seat longer than Hillary Clinton did. She also has a clear signature issue.
If we have 26,000 sexual assaults and rapes every year in the military, and only 3,000 victims are willing to report, you have a huge structural problem.
That's Gillibrand back in 2013, urging the U.S. military to change how it responds to sexual assault accusations. She's long pushed for policies like federal paid family leave and used her political organization to try and get more women to run for office. So when the Me Too moment came to Congress, Gillibrand was ready. She sponsored a bill changing how Congress processes and responds to harassment complaints.
The way it's set up in Congress is so horrible. I mean, it is literally designed to protect perpetrators.
Several high-profile Republicans have signed on, including Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Gillibrand was also the first Democrat to call on Minnesota Senator Al Franken to resign, despite a close relationship that included regular squash games between the two Democrats.
That was difficult. It was very difficult because this is somebody I really do care about and think has done great work in the Senate. But the truth is, if we are defending this behavior but not that behavior and talking about this, the gradations between sexual assault versus harassment versus groping and then where on the body you're groping, I just don't think that's the right conversation to be having.
A cascade of Democrats quickly followed suit, but since then there's been some backlash. West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin urged Franken to withdraw his resignation, calling the demands from Gillibrand and other Democrats hypocritical.
It's just unbelievable to me how you can destroy a human being's life and his family and everything that they stand for without giving them a chance.
That was on CNN. Gillibrand says while Franken had a right to an ethics committee investigation, she had a right to her opinion. This has all put Gillibrand in the news day after day, though her profile had been rising all year, since a speech at the Women's March the day after President Trump was inaugurated.
This is the moment that you are going to be heard!
It all seems a far cry from January 2009, when Patterson and Gillibrand stood on a crowded Albany stage to announce her surprise appointment.
I realize that for many New Yorkers, this is the first time you've heard my name, and you don't know much about me.
One thing many New York Democrats quickly heard about, the relatively conservative view she held at the time on hot-button progressive issues like gun control.
You know, in upstate New York, you typically shoot the Thanksgiving turkey, so that's what we do. And so I've always wanted to protect hunters' rights because it's such an important part of our culture. It's an important part of our heritage. It's an important part of upstate New York. So I'm going to be an advocate for hunters' rights, but there is so much area where there's common ground where I can work together with anti-gun, really solving the problem of gun violence.
Patterson says he picked Gillibrand knowing she'd be an excellent senator 10 years down the road.
I knew she would not be the best senator at the moment I appointed her. She struggled a little bit, kind of explaining her positions.
Gillibrand credits an early turnaround to something that keeps coming up during her interview with NPR, listening, whether that's listening to other lawmakers or to constituents.
There's areas in my own history where I didn't know why it was important. And when I did, I changed my opinion. And that certainly could be said for my views on trying to end gun violence and certainly my views on immigration reform.
Gillibrand has been steadily increasing her stature in the Democratic Party and in the Senate over the last few years. So that's put her in a similar position that her predecessor was in. Listen to how Hillary Clinton fielded questions about a presidential run when she was still in the Senate and running for a second term.
I'm going to stay focused on this election because I don't want to take anything for granted.
Here's how Gillibrand is responding to those same questions.
Well, I really aspire to getting reelected next year, so I'm very focused on that.
Scott Detrow, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning, it's 8:18, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. NPR headlines are coming up next, and during the WPR newscast, people interested in hemp farming attended an event in western Wisconsin recently to learn more about growing the crop. More on that story in a couple minutes during the statewide newscast.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
With poinsettias and fresh evergreens, WPR is pleased to promote family-friendly events. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. An investigation is underway to determine the cause of a deadly fire at a New York City high-rise apartment building. One person was killed and two firefighters suffered injuries when the blaze broke out yesterday morning. Deputy Assistant Fire Chief Joe Wasnicka says windy conditions and malfunctioning elevators made rescue efforts on the 35th floor difficult.
When you have a wind-driven fire like that, it creates a much more dangerous and difficult operation for our members to get into that hallway with the heat and fire conditions that they're facing.
The blaze was contained to one apartment. NASA's next Mars probe is undergoing final assembly and testing before it launches next spring. As NPR's Joe Palca reports, its mission is to understand how the red planet formed.
InSight carries instruments that will record Mars quakes, measure heat coming from the core of the planet, and detect slight wobbles as the planet rotates around the sun. All information that will inform scientists how the planet formed. It was supposed to launch 2 years ago, but the Mars quake instrument wasn't ready.
NPR's Joe Palca reporting. Trading is set to get underway on Wall Street this morning. Markets were closed yesterday for the Christmas holiday. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Around 100 farmers gathered in Barron County last week to learn about growing hemp. Minnesota hemp farmer John Strofus spoke about growing, processing, and marketing hemp products. Governor Scott Walker signed a bill in November greenlighting hemp production. Since then, Strofus says he's received at least 2 calls a day from Wisconsinites.
I'm hopeful that the excitement is not generated by a false sense of opportunity financially. I think hemp can be a good cash crop, can certainly be better than corn, be competitive or higher than soybeans at current prices.
Strofa says initial reports of farmers making $1,000 per acre is unrealistic. He says hemp profits are more likely to be in the $200 and $300 per acre range, similar to what farmers can expect from soybeans. The Eau Claire Public Library will soon be waiving late fees and will no longer fine people for most late items. Officials say they're trying to get more people to return to the library. According to the Leader-Telegram, about 8,000 people are blocked from checking out materials because they owe fines of $10 or more. Starting next Monday, those late fees are being eliminated, and people are being urged to return their overdue books and materials. Many of the people who have been blocked are children or low-income residents. Late fees will still be charged for kits, equipment, and materials from other libraries. People will also need to pay a fee for damaged or lost items checked out. You're listening to WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com. From care.com, offering home pay, a solution for nanny payroll, tax, and HR obligations, from automatic payments to preparing state and federal tax returns. Learn more at care.com/NPR. From Home Instead Senior Care, with a range of in-home senior care services to keep senior loved ones at home. Providing help with bathing, medication reminders, and Alzheimer's and dementia care. At homeinstead.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. And deep inside northeast India, a forest has come bounding back thanks to one man. He's a farmer. NPR's Julie McCarthy traveled to see him, and she has this report.
We've come to one of the most geographically isolated parts of India, the northeast, nestled along the borders of China, Bhutan, and Bangladesh. We arrange ourselves in a boat for a short journey to a river island in Assam, a state famous for tea, the mighty Brahmaputra River we're crossing, and the forest man. Jadav Payang, a 58-year-old farmer, keeps the hours of an insomniac. By 4:30 a.m., we're gliding across a moonlit channel. A pink sky pushes out the stars. The slap of his oar is all that breaks the pre-dawn tranquility. We alight on an island of some 250 families from the Mishing tribe that lives along the riverbanks. And Jadav begins the daily trek to his vegetable fields and his life's mission, reviving the ecosystem here.
It's now become full of grasslands and plants and a forest.
When Jadav was young, the son of a poor buffalo trader, this strip of land in the middle of the river was attached to the mainland. Erosion from the river severed it. Jadav picks up a handful of earth and explains how the landscape has changed.
Earlier, this was all sand. No trees, no grass. Nothing was here. Only driftwood.
Now pastures nourish cows. Cotton trees stand straight in rows as far as the eye can see. Jodiff planted them, his hands transforming this once barren island the size of Martha's Vineyard.
First, with bamboo trees. I kept planting all different kinds of trees.
He says once a tree seeds, the wind, the birds, the entire ecosystem knows how to sow them. Jodiff started planting here in 1979, stirred by a freakish sight. Snakes piled on the sand in scorching heat. They'd perished from lack of shade. When I saw it, he says, I thought, even we humans will have to die this way in the heat. In the grief of those dead snakes, I created this forest. Local tribesmen advised Jodiff to plant tall grasses to protect the reptiles. Over the course of nearly four decades, Jodiff says he's planted so many trees, he's lost count. Barefoot, this Mishing tribesman prunes plants as he guides us to some of his oldest trees. He leans against a 30-year-old teak tree and points to scratches on the bark. A tiger has sharpened its claws. Jodiff is saying that he's lost 85 cows and 95 buffalo to tigers who have eaten them, killed them. He describes coming face to face with one of the big cats. What went through your head? Were you scared to death?
No, I wasn't scared. I know that tigers have half the courage of women. This one killed a buffalo, saw me, and slinked off.
He says, unafraid of the wild elephants that cross the river to roam his forest. Island villagers complain the herd tramples their rice fields and homes. But Jodiff defends the animal and says it is man that must adjust to these woods. Jodiff has received one of India's highest civilian awards. The dense forest bears his name and now sprawls over 1,300 acres. India's forest man personifies dedication to a dream. Rising at 4 a.m., paddling across the river nearly every day for almost 40 years. Certainly, most people, if they acted on it, wouldn't stick with it for 40 years. How did you do that? How do you do that? No one sees God, says Jodiff Payeng. I see God in nature. Nature is God, he says. It gives me inspiration. It gives me power. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Assam, India.
All right, Noelle, I was lucky enough to have you as my secret Santa at the office party this year, which was cool. You got me this delicious syrup.
Yes, from my hometown of Kerhonkson in upstate New York.
Nice. I cannot wait to taste it. And I got to say also the gift bag was on point. I loved it. And that's important. It matters because we've been thinking a lot about gift preparation. Last week, we visited this master rapper, Mia Canada, while she was on the job.
Just the thought of the wrapping itself, you know, it creates an experience.
It does, but here's the thing. According to a new study, if you put something in a fancy package, there'd better be something good inside.
You see a Tiffany box, you don't expect chocolate to come out of it.
That is Uzma Khan. She teaches marketing at the University of Miami. And she was part of this team of researchers that found people are even more disappointed when they get a bad gift in a fancy package than if it was just like wrapped in newspaper. Tom Easton wrote about this study for The Economist, and he told us over Skype that people getting the gifts get a message from the wrapping.
Their expectations rise to a tremendous level, and then they unwrap it, and what do they feel? Nothing but disappointment.
All right. Well, one way around this problem, choose a good gift. That's what Uzma Khan did for her 5-year-old son on Christmas.
Oh, his I wrapped up with big ribbons and bows because I knew that he was going to be aesthetic.
And how did he react?
He went a little crazy and started running around screaming that this was the best day of his life. So he was very happy, I would say.
All right. Now, the sample size of the study was small. So if you still think you can impress using style over substance, you can disregard our advice. Then again, if you're thinking about re-gifting some ugly socks, for example, maybe look in the recycling bin for some old newspaper. This is NPR News.
When we first heard from Iraqi refugee Ahmed Badr in June, he told us about a website he started to help young people tell their stories. Now it's taken off.
At the end of the day, I don't want to be the exception. I'd much rather be the rule and show youth all over the Middle East that this is possible, that you can transcend your circumstances.
I'm Robert Siegel. We check in with Ahmed Badr this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and still to come this hour, for a small percentage of people who smoke marijuana, long-term use can make them sick with a violent vomiting illness. We'll find out more about that in about 15 minutes. Good morning. It's 8:30. I'm Maureen McCollum in Wisconsin Public Radio News. Police in the village of Caledonia say two people have admitted to stealing a Salvation Army red kettle. The suspects are being held in the Racine County Jail. The 34-year-old woman and her 35-year-old boyfriend allegedly told investigators they took the contents of the kettle from a Walgreens store to support their heroin habit. Their names have not been released. Police say they received several tips from the public after they released surveillance video from the store. The video showed the woman posing as a kettle attendant for about an hour before grabbing it and getting into a car driven by a second person. The Wisconsin Badgers are trying to top off one of the school's best ever football seasons with a fourth straight bowl victory. The number 6 Badgers are facing the number 11 University of Miami Hurricanes in the Orange Bowl on Saturday. A win against the Hurricanes would give coach Paul Christ and his team a Badger record 13 victories and would ensure a top 10 ranking for a second straight season. There are challenges since the Orange Bowl is basically a home game for the Hurricanes, but the Badgers have had 4 weeks to get over the disappointment of missing the playoffs for the national championship. This is WPR.
Morning Edition, Classical Music, Wisconsin Life. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn more about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org. Thank you.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
There is a wind chill advisory in effect statewide. It's going to be incredibly cold today and into tomorrow. There's also wind chill warnings for some far northern Wisconsin counties. That means frostbite could occur within 15 minutes without proper clothing. Wind chill values will range from negative 15 to negative 35 in the north, negative 10 to negative 25 in the south.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org. From MileIQ, the MileIQ app automatically tracks business miles to streamline and maximize deductions or expenses. The MileIQ app is available for download in the App Store and Google Play. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. And we're looking back this morning at how the economy did last year, 2017, and what we can expect in the coming year. David Wessel is with us. He's director of the Hutchins Center at Brookings and a contributor to The Wall Street Journal. Hey, David.
Good morning.
Hey, so we hit the end of the year and the economy looks pretty good, right?
It does. The economy got off to a soft start in 2017, but it's been growing at a reasonably healthy pace lately. The unemployment rate, which was 4.7% at the end of last year, is down to 4.1% at last count. The last time it was this low, Bill Clinton was president 17 years ago. The U.S. has added a couple million jobs in the past year, all of them in the private sector. Government employment has actually fallen a bit. We're drawing a lot of people from the sidelines of the job market into the economy. Inflation is low. The stock market has risen about 19% in the past year. Interest rates are still low, although they're starting to go up a little bit. In short, we're going into 2018 with really impressive momentum.
Momentum sounds good. So what are your predictions for 2018?
Well, the best guess is more of the same, barring some big disruption like a shooting war with North Korea or a trade war with Mexico or something. The economies of the U.S. and those of our major trading partners are strengthening. The tax cut, the big tax cut, plus some expected increases in federal spending for hurricanes and other things are going to give the economy a boost in 2018, although some depends on how businesses and rich folks choose to use their tax savings. It's incredible. Most economists see unemployment falling towards 3.5% in 2018, which is remarkable. That should be low enough to at last push up wages. The Fed is on track to raise interest rates from still low levels by maybe 3-4 times in 2018, but the economy and the markets now seem strong enough to absorb that.
I mean, one thing we're going to hear a lot about in 2018 is 10 years since the housing bubble burst and the financial crisis and the Great Recession. So how is the housing market looking today?
Well, housing is finally coming back. Sales of existing homes have been strong. Builders are picking up the pace of building new homes. Nationally, home prices are up about 6% over the past year. They're now above where they were before the housing bust. And thanks to that, only 5% of homeowners with mortgages own more than the value of their homes. That's way, way down from a few years ago. Now, there are pockets where things are worse, Las Vegas, Chicago, Miami, Scranton, Pennsylvania. The tax bill does curtail some tax breaks for housing, but I don't think that's going to disrupt the near-term trend.
All right, so it's mostly sounding good, but I know that you did want to talk about the things we should be worried about in 2018.
Right. You know, I remember when Alan Greenspan left the Fed, everybody thought everything was wonderful. And 2 years later, we're in the worst recession of our lifetimes.
Yeah.
Any year, there's about a 20% chance of recession. And recessions are almost impossible for economists to predict. So it's worth thinking about what could go wrong. Well, the Fed could be spooked by inflation and lift interest rates more than anticipated, slowing the economy, disrupting financial markets. We could see a big confidence-shattering drop in stock markets. It's been up so long, it's bound to come down. We could see some problems in the banking system that turns out we didn't put enough seatbelts and airbags in. Trump's talk on trade could turn from tough talk to disrupting global supply chains. So there are a lot of things that could go wrong. And what's hard about a time like this, when everything looks wonderful, it's hard to predict what is the one thing that's going to break the back of the economy. And then there are some really big long-term problems out there,
which I don't think we have time, unfortunately, to get into, but we will at some point in 2018. David Wessel is a director of the Hutchins Center at Brookings and a contributor to The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much, David.
You're welcome.
Many Puerto Ricans are still without electricity and even basic services 3 months after Hurricane Maria, but that has not dampened everyone's mood. Some are still finding time to sing, dance, even celebrate. Jeff Cohen from member station WNPR recently visited a nonprofit in the town of Calle that opens its doors on weekend nights for musicians and music lovers.
After the storm blew out her windows, Maria Anith Rodriguez lost water, internet, power, and her entire home office. Her company offered her a one-way ticket to be with family in New Britain, Connecticut, but she refused. For her, it was round trip or nothing. She wanted to come back.
I went to New Britain for 10 days. Not for me, for them. For my daughters. You know, they have to see me that I was okay.
But now she's back in Puerto Rico and she faces a choice. She works from home, but she can't work without electricity and internet. So either she stays here and loses her job or she leaves.
I think that at the end of December, I have to decide if the situation in Puerto Rico doesn't get normal.
It's all a lot to think about, which is why sometimes she tries not to think about it at all. So most Friday and Saturday nights, you'll find her here, dancing and socializing at the Casa Histórica de la Música Callejana. It's a nonprofit organization in the heart of Calle that celebrates the history of the town's music and musicians. And on nights like this one, they host free concerts for people like Rodriguez to come and, as she says, breathe. The concerts have happened for about a year. They seem to have a special resonance now.
And seeing your friend after Maria is like seeing them after a long trip. And in Puerto Rico, everything we celebrate with music, even funerals.
Andres Yambo is one of the founders of the Music House. He told me they had to pack up and empty everything twice this year, once for Hurricane Irma and once again for Maria.
Este espacio se utilizó después de Maria.
Yambo says that a week after the hurricane, musicians and friends came together here to sing by candlelight. He likens living after Maria to what happens when you lose a family member. He says you carry the trauma with you, but you don't let the loss get in your way. Yambo plays an instrument called the cuatro, but his real job is working nights as a radiology technician. The singer who started the night off, Yambo says he's an accountant. Didi Melendez is a regular here. She spent the night dancing in front of her chair. Maria took the roof off her house. Friends in the diaspora, Chicago, Connecticut, New York, helped her put it back. She comes here because she too says Puerto Ricans can't only live in sadness.
Porque necesitamos la música, necesitamos la alegría, necesitamos.
She says people need music, they need happiness, and they need to feel alive. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Cohen.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:41. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. News headlines from NPR are next, and we'll also have statewide news in the WPR newscast. And later this hour, we'll hear more on Morning Edition and the top albums of 2017. Stay tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR's old-time radio drama is coming to Wausau. Hi, I'm Norman Gilliland. Join me and the 9XM Players for a family-friendly performance of Oscar Wilde's Canterville Ghost at UW Marathon County on February 9th. Experience the golden age of radio with period costumes, sound effects, live music, and more. Find details at wpr.org/ghost.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Russian officials say legal experts will check to see whether a call by opposition leader Alexei Navalny to boycott next year's presidential election complies with the law. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford reports their conclusions could be used to bolster police action against Navalny and his supporters.
The Kremlin spokesman said Mr. Navalny's call for a mass boycott of the presidential election needs scrupulous study to determine whether it complies with Russian law. There is no doubt that Vladimir Putin is the out-and-out favorite in this election. But after 18 years in power, his team is struggling to inject energy into a predictable process.
A storm that left more than 160 people dead over the weekend in the Philippines has been downgraded to a tropical depression. As Michael Sullivan reports, authorities in Vietnam had been expecting the worst.
Vietnamese officials were taking no chances. They evacuated hundreds of thousands of people from the low-lying Mekong Delta region just in case, after forecasters predicted Tembin would make landfall near the southern tip of the region. It didn't happen, and the storm is now expected to dissipate over the Gulf of Thailand.
Stocks are trading mixed at this hour on Wall Street. The Dow is up 5 points at 24,760. The Nasdaq down 36 points. The S&P down 2. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Organic Valley has announced they'll run solely on renewable energy by 2019. As Hope Kerwin reports, the Wisconsin-based cooperative is helping launch up to a dozen new solar projects in rural communities around the region.
Organic Valley has agreed to purchase power from a group of municipal utilities in order to fund new solar projects in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa. Stanley Minnick from Organic Valley says the projects will make solar more accessible for rural communities.
Whether you could afford to participate in a green program or whether you can afford solar on your home or not, if you're in one of these towns and you get electricity from one of these, you know, municipal utilities, you're going to, over the life of the system, save money on your electric bill.
Construction on the projects will begin next spring. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A flurry of real estate transactions should be completed by the end of the week in Mount Pleasant. Taiwan-based electronics giant Foxconn Technology Group has deposited $60 million for the village to start acquiring land for the new flat-screen manufacturing plant. The deadline for the village to exercise purchase options on 1,400 acres is Friday. Eventually, the massive operation could cover more than twice that area and employ up to 13,000 workers. There's a wind chill advisory in effect for the entire state of Wisconsin. People are urged to be careful when they're outside. You're listening to WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform committed to helping get work done in today's modern workforce. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. A small percentage of people who smoke marijuana find that long-term use makes them sick with this violent vomiting illness. And in California, pot will be fully legalized in July. So doctors there worry that they might see more cases of this mysterious syndrome. Reporter Pauline Bartoloni has the story.
Marijuana has been legal for medical use in California for longer than two decades. And as Shelfante Lene Queen points out about her neighbors at her San Diego apartment complex, smoking pot is a way of life here.
Everybody here smokes. Smoke weed, smoke weed, smoke weed, smoke weed.
Queen's 48 years old and says she's been smoking pot since she was a teenager. She says it helps her deal with depression and anxiety. But after 5 years of smoking all day, every day, Queen started to get very ill.
My first time that I was actually sick and couldn't stop vomiting and in a great deal of pain and hospitalized, I was there for, I think, 3 or 4 days.
That scenario played out over and over again for almost two decades.
You're out of your mind in pain. Like, I've screamed out for death. I've cried out for my mom, who's been dead for 20 years, mentally not realizing she can't come to me.
Queen and her healthcare providers never got to the bottom of what was causing her vomiting episodes. She dropped down to a frail 109 pounds and was dismissed from a job.
I'm literally thinking I'm dying. I must have some sort of cancer, something they can't detect.
Finally, a year and a half ago, an emergency physician gave her something to read about a condition called cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome.
And that's when I Googled it. And that's when I figured it out.
People who smoke cannabis may be doubtful that the drug is linked to this strange vomiting illness. Truth is, the medical community has only recognized this syndrome for a little over a decade. A Colorado study found the number of people with the symptoms doubled when medical marijuana use surged.
This is something that we've been seeing for many years, but has really increased in frequency.
Dr. Amy Moulin works in the emergency department at UC Davis Medical Center. She estimates she sees the syndrome every other shift. She says it's frustrating because there's no one remedy.
I'd have someone who was very distressed, intractable vomiting, and I would give them my usual cocktail of medications that almost always worked, and it wouldn't work.
Doctors say these episodes are expensive. That's because to rule out other medical problems, they have to order CAT scans and lab tests. Moulin says even when she tells patients to lay off the marijuana, they come back.
A lot of times they don't believe me. I think it's because it's an under-recognized syndrome. Marijuana is used for nausea, and so it's difficult sometimes for people to make that leap of regular heavy use can actually cause vomiting.
Back in San Diego, Shelfante Lene Queen says she's relieved she finally got a diagnosis. She's back to a healthy weight and hasn't been back to the hospital in a year. She's cut down on her pot smoking, but not given it up completely.
I don't want to discourage anybody from smoking weed or whatever at all. I just want people to just be aware that it exists. Now, if I get sick, as sad as I'll be and as upset and disappointed with myself as I be, at least it's a freaking choice.
Queen and the medical community say, as marijuana laws loosen, they want people to know about this syndrome, so they have that choice too. I'm Pauline Bartoloni in San Diego.
Pauline Bartoloni is with our partner, Kaiser Health News. This is NPR News.
It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. The music starts, classical music starts in about 15 minutes, but first we'll hear more of the best music from 2017. Morning Edition talks with the people who cover different styles of music and ask them to pick their favorite albums from this last year. See if yours made the list. Next, here on Morning Edition.
WPR has been a radio pioneer since 1917. That's 100 years of great radio. Today, listener support is the single largest piece of funding for WPR, so you can be proud of that legacy. Thanks to you, WPR's future includes more in-depth news, world-class music, and great discussions. Continue the spirit of innovation. Make your year-end gift now at WPR.org. Thank you.
There is a wind chill advisory statewide, and that should last until tomorrow. Wind chill warning in some far northern Wisconsin counties. That means frostbite could occur within 15 minutes if you're not properly dressed. Wind chill values will range from negative 15 to negative 35 in northern Wisconsin and from negative 10 to negative 25 in the southern region of the state.
Contributors to WPR include the Bayfield Berry Farms, Chad's Design Build, and the Worm Farm Institute. You, too, can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. Allow the compassionate, caring staff at Piasecki Althaus to take care of your funeral needs, serving the community since 1931.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. How do you pick the best albums of 2017? It's a matter of taste, right? If you don't like classical, you don't even consider classical records.
It is just that simple. So we talked to various people who cover different styles of music, and we asked what their favorite records of the year were.
Yes, starting with Julie Height. She reports on music from Nashville, and for her, the most important record of the year was the comeback album by Leanne Womack, The Lonely, The Lonesome, and The Gone.
Leanne Womack is sort of a modern traditionalist. She was a mainstream hit maker in the late 90s. With this particular album, she kind of was trying to get to what she feels like is the emotional core of country music. It's melancholy.
The deck is stacked against you. Life's a losing hand. Even when you think you're up, you're right back down again. Either way you play it, the house is gonna win.
You know, the contemporary country music, you just don't hear a lot of people really going to deep, dark places emotionally. I mean, there definitely has been more upbeat, good times, party music. It felt right to be listening to a country album that makes so much room for devastation of so many different kinds, intimate or existential crises and that sort of thing.
All right, so moving on from country, Kiana Fitzgerald writes about R&B and hip-hop for the magazine Complex. She loved Control. It's the debut album from SZA.
She was supposed to be a rapper when she first came out, and I think that really lends itself to her songwriting ability. She constructs these little universes in each of her songs that are just relatable.
You know I'm sensitive about having no booty, having nobody, only you, buddy. Can you hold me when nobody's around us? Open your heart up.
This album is about control, something that women are constantly struggling to obtain, whether that's in relationships, whether that's professionally, socially. SZA really just came forward and said, I took control of my own narrative, and I want you as women to understand that you can take control of your own narrative. And it just came out at a time where I was getting over a breakup, or whatever you want to call it. It was complicated. You know, I was clinging to this album because it was so restorative for me. Hope you never find who I really am, cause you'll never love me. You'll never love me. You'll never love me. But I believe you when you say it like this.
And then, of course, there was jazz in 2017. Nate Chenin is with the jazz radio station WBGO, and he really loved a record by trumpeter Ron Miles. It's called I Am a Man.
Ron Miles is just a beautiful musician. He's someone with this tone that's like liquid gold. On this album, he applies that gorgeous sensibility to a sort of reflection on civil rights, identity, on justice. There were so many ambitious and envelope-pushing albums made by jazz musicians in 2017. This is a subtler accomplishment, but what it does is it really establishes this kind of soulful beauty. And I found myself, in a year of turbulence and conflict, reaching for it again and again. You know, it was replenishing. You know, it's just a beautiful statement.
Mentioned classical. Well, a lot of people love it, and that includes Tom Heisinger, who writes about classical music for NPR Music. His vote for best album is from the Danish String Quartet. It's an album called Last Leaf.
When these guys aren't playing Beethoven and Brahms, they kind of hole up in this vintage farmhouse in the west side of Denmark, and they pore over all of these old folk tunes from the Nordic countries. You can virtually see shuffling feet on a sawdusted dance floor and hear these wheezing old squeeze boxes in the music. Like an evocative novel or some mesmerizing movie, I love art that like completely pulls you into its own special world where you end up getting to have personal relationships with the characters. And in this case, it's the songs that you get to know and love.
And of course, we couldn't talk about popular music without talking to Ann Powers. She covers pop music for NPR, all kinds of pop music. Her favorite album this year was Rainbow by the pop star Kesha.
For the past several years, Kesha has been involved in a legal battle with her ex-producer, Dr. Luke. She accused him of sexual abuse and other forms of abuse, including the harassment that led to her suffering from an eating disorder for which she was treated. And during the time of that treatment, she began writing the songs for Rainbow.
I'd forgot how to daydream. So consumed with the wrong things, but in the dark, I realized this life is short.
I have a 14-year-old daughter, and we listened a lot to this record together. Kesha's message of empowerment, which is not a simple message, which makes room for vulnerability, for being a weirdo, that's a message that resonates so much with my daughter and so much with me. It's a record I wish I'd had when I was 14.
You gotta learn to let it go. Put the past behind you, trust me, I know. The ghosts will try to find you, but just put those colors on.
I am so with Ann Powers. That Kesha album is awesome. All right, there you have it. Some of the best albums of the year from five different perspectives.
And if you didn't hear your favorite, we've also got a huge list of others at our website, nprmusic.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green.
And you can hear Morning Edition Monday through Friday from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you want to follow our news throughout the day, go online, WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR. Stay with us. Classical music and headlines are next.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Esther News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, with homemade soups, salads, and sandwiches being served daily at their historic soda fountain. Stop by Jack Andrea today for lunch and an old-fashioned soda. JackAndrea.com.
You're listening to WGTD.